And together, we are Blogging Heads TV.
It's nice to be here with you today, Jim.
Thank you, Jane. Nice to be with you.
A good piece in the Huffington Post this morning.
Well, thank you. I tried to set up the situation in Russia and Georgia in terms of American politics. And as I said, you know, with apologies to George W. Bush, I don't think that he saw clearly into Vladimir Putin's soul 7 years ago. I think that Putin was putting on his KGB happy face, and Bush fell for it. And then I also said, with apologies to Al Gore, I don't think that the Russians are going to make their invasion of Georgia carbon neutral in terms of its, you know, carbon emissions footprint. And I think that the whole environmental movement sort of depends on a degree of international cooperation that is obviously lacking, at least as far as the Russians are concerned. And then with apologies to Bill Clinton, I don't think that the Chinese are quote, strategic partners, unquote. I think that the Chinese have every intention of overtaking us, and their long-term goal is the same as ours, to be the world's leading power. And I think that sets up an inevitable conflict sometime in the coming century.
So you think that you're one of the people who watches the Olympics with an eye toward meets your new Chinese overlords?
Yes. I thought that their opening ceremony, which was the most spectacular, you know, human event I'd ever seen, but was sort of notable in not making any concessions to the West. It was their show, their summer. They did the Olympics their way. They made no pretense of expanding human rights or anything like that. And the opening ceremony was a pan to Chinese culture. You know, the Chinese have been the dominant civilization in the world for most of the last 5,000 years. They sort of lost their mojo, if you will, in the last, you know, half millennium, beginning in the 15th century. And now they're out to get it back, and I think they're doing so, and I think you know, we will be shocked at how little interested they are in taking instruction from Americans.
Well, let me ask you, in regard to the opening ceremonies, I guess it's amazing what you can do with $150 million, but were you looking for something more traditional along the lines of Steven Tyler and Aerosmith? you know, I thought it was pretty impressive, and I kind of liked that they were true to their own culture.
I agree. It was impressive, and for exactly that reason. I mean, if the Americans done it, there would have been Billy Crystal telling jokes, and, you know, and maybe for our Americans' idea of a foreigner, we would have brought in, you know, Paul McCartney.
Are you worried about Justin Timberlake's employment prospects?
The point is, the Chinese just, you know, have obviously incredibly deep reserves of culture and greatness and grandeur, and, you know, they know how to put on a show, and they were putting on shows and so on when, you know, most people in the West were you know, painting themselves blue. And so I just think that and coincidentally, of course, there's a report this week that showed that the Chinese had overtaken America as the number one manufacturing power in the world.
I was surprised that it took until now. Walmart's been helping him out.
I mean, we've been helping him out, exactly. And we seem determined to deindustrialize our country, even as we declare ourselves to be antagonistic to Chinese ends in Tibet and in Taiwan. And, of course, from a geopolitical point of view, the worst thing you can do ever is to make commitments that you can't keep. That's a little bit of what happened in the former Soviet Republic of Georgia.
Well, I was going to say, steer back to Georgia, because I'm still interested in what you have to say about John McCain and his kind of roaring, belligerent, you know, let's surround Russia with NATO and return to the days of the Cold War and you know, threaten wars that we can't back up. How are you feeling about that?
I'm not for that. I'm opposed to, I mean, I'm generally opposed to war, and I'm certainly opposed to wars you can't win. Look, what McCain speaks to, though, is the kind of, you know, belligerence of what, you know, political scientists call the Jacksonian vote, you know, the as in Andrew Jackson, not Jesse Jackson, the whole meme, M-E-M-E, of the Scotch-Irish, and their kind of, you know, war fighting, you know, activist style of, you know, of conflict. McCain, you know, whose roots are from in Mississippi, from the family, clearly taps into that, and that's much, unfortunately for Obama, I think that's much closer to where the American people are right now in terms of their tone and attitude than an Obama who sort of talks about, you know, international cooperation. Now,
most of the people in this country do not want war with Iraq anymore. They want out of the country, and I don't think they want an extra war.
That's true too. But what the concern is that, I mean, what McCain is tapping into is, look, if the Russians are going to, you know, clobber this little country, we at least ought to be tough on the Russians. And so McCain's speech just a little while ago, today, Tuesday, in Pennsylvania, I thought hit the right notes. He talked about, how great Georgia was and how it was a Christian country and so on and so on, and a democracy. Didn't mention any of his lobbyist connections to Georgia.
Now, what does the fact that Georgia is a Christian country have to do with anything?
It has to do with the natural instinct of Western Christians to defend each other. That's how the West organized to defeat the Turks in the 16th century, the Battle of Lepanto. It was how, in the 17th century, the Polish king, John Sobieski, led an army to defeat the Turks besieging Vienna in 1683.
I'm going to go on a limb here and say that the last 8 years have kind of discredited the whole let's be a Christian nation, you know, marching out against the infidels. I just don't think that that's playing real well right now.
Well, I agree that it's not playing very well in Iraq.
That is kind of the looming awfully large.
Right, and I agree it's not playing very well in Afghanistan. I mean, I don't know how you can defend the right of Western media to show Muhammad cartoons, and then expect the Afghans and the Iraqis and anybody else in the Muslim world to like you. It's especially if you're invading their countries, it doesn't go together very well. However, the point about the Christians uniting to defend themselves. I mean, McCain said it, so it's clearly a thought that has some resonance in the culture. And I mean, I actually wrote a piece for the American Conservative Magazine last year and called it the subtitle was The Defensive Christendom, and how obviously Christians have an interest in defending themselves, just like Muslims have an interest in defending themselves, just like Confucians have an interest in defending themselves.
There are a lot of Confucian wars going on at the moment.
There's a lot of Confucian concern that about driving the Americans out of the Pacific, the Americans in Taiwan, some sort of eventual showdown between China and Japan. So I think that the difference is that the Chinese have already shown that they are powerful enough to tell the Americans to back off.
Then why are we going and telling Russia that we're going to be policing their backyard, that we want to return to Cold War politics and pushing them into the embrace of the Chinese? It just doesn't seem very reasonable.
So far, I have not heard either Bush or McCain or anybody else for that matter say much of anything other than we oppose what the Russians are doing. And of course, the Russians won't really care what we say.
We had 130 Americans in Georgia training them ostensibly to be our part of the coalition of the willing in Iraq, but we airlifted their people out and brought them back to Georgia for this. And now we're claiming we didn't have any idea this was going down. It's not really very credible.
I agree. All I was originally saying was that McCain has hit a nerve. I mean, Obama's on vacation, and McCain is talking tough about this. And I think the real answer, of course, and this is hardly unique to me, is that one of the reasons why Russia is in an expansionist period now is because oil prices are high. You can buy a lot of aggression with $115 a barrel oil or whatever the price today is.
America is also weakened after our war with Iraq.
We
can't go in and defend anybody. It's a bunch of saber rattling that we can't back up. And probably the reason they thought that they could get away with this in Georgia was because we were going to be over their shoulder without facing the reality that we can't.
I think you're exactly right. And I'm sure the Iranians are watching all this closely, too. Look, the Iraq war did tend to illustrate the point that America is kind of a paper tiger when it comes to military stuff. We don't have the kind of power that we thought we did. And you know, there's an interesting piece by Andrew Bacevich, who's a professor at Boston University, who's no dove. He had a son in Iraq who was tragically killed a year or so ago. But I mean, Bacevich's point was that the Americans had themselves convinced that we had successfully reinvented the military, you know, blah blah blah, revolution in military affairs, da da da, and that you know the Iraq War and the Afghan War and the early going in 01 and 03 respectively proved how America had become. And Bacevich pulled out all these quotes from all various neocons saying, you know, we had the best army since Rome or the best army since apparently, you know, I mean all these you know empires of the past, and basically said this is crap. This is obviously not true, and the events in Afghanistan and Iraq since the initial shock and awe tend to support the point that we don't have the kind of military muscle that we thought we had, or at least we're not willing to use it. And this is the kind of I agree. This is the sort of weakness that the Russians or the whoever's you know can. We'll be strategizing about saying, look, if the Americans can't stop us or won't stop us, then why not take over Georgia? And I was also thinking about other places around the world, too, that are sort of similarly situated. One is Taiwan. Another one is Brunei, you know, the very rich oil sultanate in the Indonesian archipelago.
I think it's a leap to think that they're going from patrolling their own, trying to secure their own borders into Taiwan. But be that mad as it may, Gorbachev had an op-ed in the Washington Post today where he said that this never would have happened without the United States having egged the Georgians on. Does the fact that John McCain is participating in this make you at all nervous about what the foreign policy of a McCain administration would look like?
Yes. I think that, I mean, it is interesting that Russians across the spectrum seem to support the general line that the Russians are taking. Just the other day, I was watching C-SPAN in the wake of the death of Alexander Solzhenitsyn, and they had a little they dug up a show that they had done on Solzhenitsyn's writings from 2 years ago, and from 2006, including both of Solzhenitsyn's sons, who were in their 30s, one of whom lives in America, one still lives in Russia. And they made the point that one of Solzhenitsyn, the late Solzhenitsyn's great causes as a Russian political figure in the last 20 years was the fate of 25 million, let's repeat, 25 million Russians who lived outside of the Russian borders. They lived in Ukraine or Kazakhstan or wherever. Now, there's a lot of reasons for this. So the Russians played a lot of games with their own borders and internal boundaries and so on in the Soviet era. But the fact remains now that there are 25 million Russians living, I would imagine, as minorities in all these other countries, including Georgia. And this is an enormous issue to Russians. Now, Americans are, you know, as is our wont, are kind of oblivious to, you know, foreign affairs and details and so on and so on and so on like that. But you can be darn sure that every Russian is completely aware, as aware of the fate of Russians in the near abroad as Americans are of, you know, the fate of Kayleigh Anthony or, you know, or JonBenet Ramsey. And so we have to think about that in terms of, look, did we really think it was a good idea for Georgia to join NATO? Do the 26 NATO countries really see that an attack on Georgia, if Georgia were to be a member of NATO,
defend Georgia, get into war with Russia, basically.
Exactly. And I think that, I mean, I saw, it was sort of my amusement, David Cameron, who's the conservative leader of the Tory party in Britain, saying, oh, we should accelerate our efforts to make Georgia a member of NATO. Well, I'm not sure that Georgia will exist in 6 months in time to be a member of NATO, and I really strongly doubt that very many countries in NATO would want Georgia in, precisely because they don't want to get in a war with Russia. And so, again, we go back to the point where I think we agree, which is it is extremely dangerous to be talking overly tough in a situation like this, where you could talk your way into a conflict that you really don't want, and I'm not even sure you can win. At the same time, it's extremely dangerous to not be tough enough. And I think that the what's so striking about American politics in the last, you know, few weeks, and I think that the Russian invasion of Georgia will dramatically accelerate that, is the effort to produce more domestic energy in the United States. Because people will say, listen, all our enemies, whether it's Iran or Russia or, you know, for that matter, the Saudi Arabian government, which I think is kind of at best, you know, here and there in terms of their attitude towards America, in terms of, you know, bin Laden and al-Qaeda and so on, surely we need a better plan for defunding these people than we have now. And I think whichever politician, whether it's McCain or Obama or whoever, can get on top of that issue and say, look, we have a, you know, part of our grand strategy as a country is to produce more energy that will, you know, again, reduce oil prices and thus disempower the likes of Putin and Ahmadinejad, if that's his name.
That's a great thought, and it might have been something that we should have been thinking about for the past 20 years instead of building cars that get 6 miles to the gallon. I'm not convinced myself that increasing our oil production by 200,000 barrels a day into a world economy that produces 85 million barrels a day is going to have that much of a significant impact. But I realize that it's a priority for the oil companies to get the
I think that if we produce 2 million barrels a day, it would make a difference. Or 5 million barrels a day. Or we're simply, I mean, it doesn't have to be oil, but it clearly has to be something. And I would just say this as free advice to Obama. If what's going on now in Georgia reminds me a lot of the Hungarian crisis of 1956. You know, the people of Hungary, bless their hearts, decided they'd had enough of Stalin and Khrushchev, and so they rebelled in October of 1956. And the Americans, at least some of them, had sort of led them to believe that we would come to their aid, and we didn't. And the Hungarians were massacred by the Red Army, and it was a tragedy. But in the backwash of that, people said, well, we need a tough, strong leader. And President Eisenhower, the Republican incumbent, was much more credible as a tough, strong leader than was his Democratic challenger, Adlai Stevenson, the former governor of Illinois. And so I think that once again, an Illinois Democrat is got an enormous hurdle, which has just gotten, I think, much more enormous, to look tough and strong and kind of in keeping with the kind of impulses of the country.
I'm not seeing any evidence for an impulse in the country for somebody who's threatening wars that we can't back up. You say he struck a nerve, but I don't see any evidence of that.
Well, the nerve is McCain being even with Obama, despite the manifest problems of the country.
That was happening before anything broke out in Russia, though.
Well, you're right, and I think that now this so this will this when the smoke clears on Russia, this will add 5 points to McCain's score, and the point being that look. The ace in the hole the Republicans have always had on the Iraq War, and I opposed the Iraq War. I was against it in 2002, I was against it in 2003, and I never changed my opinion of it, although I do think we need a kind of a Nixonian solution to Iraq, and, you know, once you're in, you just can't withdraw. So that's sort of where we are. But I think that what the country feels strongly, and this is what Bush has going for him, is what McCain has going for him, it's what the Republicans have going for him, is the Americans don't want to lose. They don't want to repeat the experience of seeing the helicopter on top of the U.S. Embassy evacuating people. And I think that one of the things that crippled the Democrats in terms of foreign affairs for the last three decades has been that they seem just a little bit too happy to see America lose in Vietnam in 1975, and they've been paying a huge price for it ever since.
I think that's absurd. But you knew I was going to say that. the whole concept that this can be won or lost is ridiculous.
Is it true or false that the Republicans have had the upper hand on foreign affairs for the last 30 years?
I think that people have trusted, especially in the post-9/11 era, that the aggressive, tough talk coming out of the Republicans was appropriate to the leadership the country needed, and I think they came to regret that, and I think that they still regret it, and that's why I really deeply question whether John McCain and his unrealistic appraisal of where we are in the world after this disastrous situation we've created in the Middle East is appropriate for leadership. I'm really just not sure I believe that. I think that Obama, you know, may have some challenges to face in the polls, but I'm not sure that that's one of them.
Well, I mean, put it this way, does the gestalt about the Democrats, that the big issues the country faces are health care and global warming, seem fitting for a world full of Russians and Iranians?
I think Americans are willing to say at this point that the idea of winning in Iraq is not worth the cost of anything to them, and that it's time in a world of limited resources to prioritize health care and our jobs and our economies over some testosterone-fueled belligerent Texans' idea of winning over and spending ourselves into horrendous debt overseas. I just don't think that the reality of what's happening in people's lives is an appropriate price to pay for what's happening.
Well, of course, the issue isn't quite winning. The issue is, as both Richard Nixon, and who of course was reelected in 1972. In the middle of a war against a candidate who to me looks a lot like Obama, George McGovern, and Bush and McCain have said, you know, pretty thumpingly, that their goal then and now was peace with honor. They wanted an honorable outcome, and they said we won't let the embassy get stormed the way it was before. And I think that Obama has let it, look. I certainly understand that Obama got the nomination against Hillary, and Hillary herself has said so, because he voted for the war and Hillary voted he voted against the war, or he was against the war and Hillary voted for it.
And Mark Penn in the recent release documents was saying that he thought that was a mark of weakness.
Well,
it doesn't seem like the country is lining up that way.
Well, it doesn't seem like the Democrats are, but I think the cliche of the moment is that the Mark Penn strategy, abhorrent as it is to most Democrats, has just in fact just been picked up by the McCain campaign, which is sort of symbolic of the reality that the swing vote in America is the sort of Hillary Clinton type Democrats or Reagan Democrats or some sort of blend between the two of them, and those people are obviously hurting economically, but they're equally obviously extremely sensitive to issues of honor and patriotism and national dignity, and they're the people who Penn was targeting. Of course, it didn't help Hillary that much.
I was going to say, Jim, take it. Hillary Clinton lost.
Inside the Democratic primary.
Yeah, she didn't win.
Right, but the country is bigger than the Democratic primary. About 40 million people voted in the Democratic primary, and about 130 million will vote probably nationwide this November. And what Penn was tapping into is that, look, the Democrats have lost 7 of the last 10 presidential elections. Now, why is that? I think a lot of it has to do with the sense that the National Democratic Party is a little bit to the left of where the American people are.
Barack Obama is ahead in the polls. Now, I know this is getting interpreted as he should be being more ahead, but he is ahead of John McCain.
I think it's hard to find any non-ideologue politico in this town who doesn't have the creeping feeling that McCain's going to win. Just because all these crises and so on and so on, and the perception that Obama is just sort of a black version of McGovern, I think is sinking in. I think that what it really hit me was seeing McCain with the Harley Davidson bikers in Sturgis, South Dakota, and I thought, well, yeah, McCain is doing a great job.
That looked like that was Michael Dukakis in a tank.
I didn't see it that way, and
he's the child of privilege. He's got 9 homes. He's married to an Anheuser-Busch billionaire.
You're right.
He's not a biker from Sturgis, South Dakota.
But he was a Navy pilot, and I think that means something to these people. And I mean, look, Reagan. Nobody ever accused Ronald Reagan of being a populist. He was rich. He wore fancy suits and shoes and things like that. Nobody objected to that. But nobody could ever, nobody even attempted to tag Reagan as being outside of the mainstream of sort of American values. Now, again, the Mark Penn stuff is interesting. Again, I'm sure that Mark Penn will never be able to coin a phrase, eat lunch in this town again. After all, those memos are fully read and understood and so on.
I will disagree with you. I think that he'll be embraced for them, but that's a sad commentary
but
on the town.
But I'm saying what Penn's wisdom, such as it were, and again, I don't think it really applied very well inside the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party nominated McGovern, they nominated Mondale, they nominated Dukakis, they nominated John Kerry. Inside the Democratic Party, Obama's fine. To the country, Obama is pro-tax increase, pro-affirmative action, anti-oil exploration, anti-nuclear power. There's 8 or 10 positions that Obama has that haven't been fully explored or fleshed out before the American people, that I think would underscore the National Journal's assessment of Obama as, quote, the most liberal member of the U.S. Senate.
That assessment came from a really shallow analysis of voting records that was based on votes Obama wasn't present for. I don't think anybody considers Obama the most liberal member of the Senate. It's just not a reasonable assessment of his voting record. He voted, if you said Russ Feingold was the most liberal senator, I would say that. And Obama is opposing Russ Feingold on many things that I actually am not happy about. He was right there for all Joe Lieberman's bellicose Iran amendments. He's not liberal enough for my taste, but be that as it may, let's divvy this up and do the math here for a second, because I think this actually leads to something I'd like to ask you about. You've got Obama and he's got his left flank secured. People like me, we're not going to go anywhere. We're gonna vote for him. He's also been making a lot of centrist noises, and he's got a good section of the country, who consider themselves to be, centrist swing voters that he's locked down by saying by a lot of his recent moves. But John McCain has something of a God gap, wouldn't you say? I mean, you have some experience with the Huckabee folks, and Huckabee was popular for a reason. They don't trust John McCain. He does not have his right flank nailed down.
I agree with that. I agree that the rumblings out of the McCain campaign show a distinct neglect for the base of the party, whether it's taxes or abortion or just the general conservative family values voters coalition. I think that. Again, McCain ran weak among them in the primaries, and there's still a lot of concern. Will McCain really fight for conservative judges? It's one thing to say I'm for him now. Will he actually do it once he's in office? Will he actually insist on building a fence across the U.S.-Mexican border? He says he'll do it. If Harry Reid and Nancy Pelosi say no, or they say we will, but it'll cost you, will McCain really fight over that? So I think there are lots of issues where the conservatives are deeply troubled. I think that's where the transition, though, in people's minds of Obama away from where he was 6 months ago, which was sort of Tiger Woods or Oprah Winfrey or Colin Powell, into a much more familiar liberal mold with some strange friends like Reverend Wright and so on, has been a godsend to the McCain campaign.
Obama is now winning among people of faith. The only thing he is not winning are evangelicals. And every other category, Obama is winning against McCain.
I got news for you. Obama could win the national vote by 2 percentage points and still lose in the Electoral College. He's going to win California huge. He's going to win New York huge. He's going to win Illinois huge. And then if you add up all the Arkansas and Missouris and Montanas and whatnot, it is easy to see Obama winning by 2 points and losing the Electoral College. Now, it would be a convulsion of the country if that were to happen twice in 8 years.
I was going to say, this has happened before.
It has happened before.
Be happy about it, but we were talking about voters of faith, and you're saying that Reverend Wright turned people off. That's not the statistics. Obama's winning among people of faith.
If you look at the Pennsylvania primary, mm-hmm. Why is McCain campaigning in Pennsylvania? Because he knows that Hillary Clinton beat Obama there 2-1. Mm-hmm. And he knows that there's all these sort of alienated, bitter, gun-gripping, God-loving, unemployed people who are gravitating towards McCain because they think that Obama talks down to them. And I think it is just a sort of a fact that, you know, Obama is sort of the sum total of every Mother Jones Ford Foundation stereotype that I've ever heard. He was
born to a single mother.
You're right, he was
poor. He worked his way up. He's the American dream.
He is a beneficiary of affirmative action.
And you cannot say that he got to be editor of the Harvard Law Review by affirmative action. The man is obviously really talented, smart, and gifted.
I don't know much about the Harvard Law Review and how the editors are. I know there's many editors, actually, but I don't know how they're picked. But as Obama himself has said, I benefited from affirmative action. And I think that, what the Democrats are waking up to is that the left has inflicted wounds on the psyche of the silent majority, gleefully in some cases, as with school busing, for the last 40 years. And now the silent majority is kind of hitting back. They're saying, look, we're not going to take your Ford Foundation, Mother Jones candidate who says we need to learn Spanish and inflate our tires, and that's our solution, and that's the solution to all our problems. I don't think the American people will take it. I really don't. I think that's why, if Obama can't get above 45 or 46% in the polls, then I'm just telling you, all those undecided voters at the end are going to vote for McCain.
It's offensive to say that this guy has gotten where he is because of affirmative action and for people to load him down with that. If there are things in this country that would have kept him from achieving the position that he has, as intelligent, as talented, and as thoughtful, and as really charismatic, and he's an incredibly talented man. And to chalk that up to affirmative action and say that people are loading him down with that and saying that that's why he got where he is and that he's going to pay the price for that is insane.
Well, we'll say I do know there's a Rasmussen poll out there that says by 2.5 to 1 people oppose affirmative action. So McCain has sort of belatedly come to the conservative position on affirmative action.
Yeah, people don't like nepotism either. McCain wasn't that bright a guy. He didn't do very well at Annapolis. There's a really strong argument to be made that if it weren't for John McCain's money and his connections, that he wouldn't have had the opportunities that he got. And certainly, marrying a beer heiress got him financial resources that he would have not otherwise had. Barack Obama is very much a self-made man who overcame some significant difficulties, being of mixed race, single mother, grew up poor. He is a self-made man. The idea that he's an elitist that needs to pay a price to America for affirmative action, and John McCain is a hero of the working bikers of South Dakota, is ridiculous.
Except the working bikers don't seem to agree with you. I mean, what do you do when you tell the working bikers what they're supposed to think? And the working bikers say different.
Jim, it's a ridiculous meme that's being carried out that Barack Obama should bear these scars. And I don't think that if you look at what's going on in Pennsylvania and Ohio, it's people sitting there and sort of calmly sitting back and saying, wow, I think I'm going to really strike back at affirmative action. If that's what they're saying, that's racism. I'm sorry. It just is. If you're looking at Barack Obama and trying to make him bear this,
are you saying, just for fun, that opposing affirmative action is racism?
I am saying that if you've got people in Pennsylvania and Ohio and all through Appalachia who will not vote for Barack Obama, and this is the excuse that they're giving, I'm not convinced that that's it.
Okay, well, again, I think this sort of sums up the Democrats' problem. When people don't agree with them, they get called racist.
No!
And I think that's been... Look, I grew up in Chicago.
Okay.
Okay, and I followed all the ethnic politics as the city transitioned from sort of an Irish-dominated government with a huge black population into what it is now, which is still kind of an Irish government-dominated mayorship with a much more diverse city council, and of course not only a big black population, but also a big Hispanic population. And so I've seen the R-word thrown around in all different contexts. I can remember the 68 convention in Chicago. And when Abraham Ribicoff was accusing Mayor Daley, the old Mayor Daley, Richard J. Daley, of being a Nazi. And I thought to myself, gee, I don't think that Richard Daley is a Nazi. And yet Ribicoff, the senator from Connecticut, thought so. It split the Democrats in half, and all those blue-collar workers sort of got the hint as to what the elite Democrats thought of them. And have been voting mostly Republican ever since. And I think that is just sort of the look,
Are you saying racism is not a problem in this country anymore?
I'm not. I'm saying racism is a problem.
But I think that what you're trying to do is dress it up.
Opposition to affirmative
action. You're trying to dress it up and give it an intellectual justification and make it seem like it's pretty and it's reasonable, and it's just not.
Well, I think affirmative action is unreasonable. I think that affirmative action is better described as reverse racism, and I think it's a huge mistake, and not only is it bad for all the people concerned,
and this is a good reason, this is a reasonable reason
poisonous.
Why people in Appalachia will not vote against Barack Obama, because he is the beneficiary because of affirmative action.
I think they will vote for
racist.
For McCain because he is closer to their values.
That's another
than
way
Obama.
Of saying black man, scary black man.
No, I'm
yes,
saying that. Look, I said that. Look, 6 months ago, Obama was like Tiger Woods. Everybody loves Tiger Woods. Everybody loves Oprah. Everybody loves Colin Powell.
And what do they all have in common? They're black. It's a more heterogeneous society than that. You cannot love all black people together and say, let's make them pay the price for affirmative action.
I said.
You are a smarter man than that.
The problem that Obama has is that he's no longer seen as Oprah or Tiger or Colin-like. He is now seen as Jeremiah Wright-like. And there's plenty of evidence, including his record.
Is Jeremiah Wright responsible for affirmative action?
In the Illinois State Senate. To show that he was a doctrinaire left winger in the Illinois State Senate, and I think there's a Jerome Corsi has a book which is now apparently
which is
number
full
one.
Of lies. They just made half of it up.
Okay, well, I mean,
just like you did the Swift voting, he's not a credible Jim. I like you. Don't pull him in on your side because he'll undermine your argument.
I haven't read the Corsi book. But I also know Hyde Park.
He tried to claim that he hated his parents because he didn't dedicate the book to him. He dedicated the book at the back, and Carsey said that it wasn't a reasonable thing to dedicate it at the back. It was traditional to dedicate it at the front, and that's what justified him saying that.
Well, that sounds kind of thin to me.
Yeah, it's a little thin. You can do better than Jerome Corsi.
No, I'm not endorsing. So, in any case, where were we?
We were talking about how Barack Obama is a latte sipping beneficiary of affirmative action, and Jeremiah Wright.
Let me just be clear. I think Obama's a pretty good guy. Okay, I think he's very admirable. I think for all the reasons you say, he is to be admired. I don't dispute any of that. What I am saying, though, is that he is to the left of the American people. And look, he might win this election. I'm not God. I don't make these decisions. I'm just saying that if he loses, I can now see the contours by which he will lose. And he will lose because the basic Republican-Nixon coalition, I've always said this is still the age of Nixon, in terms of this, I agree with Rick.
I'm not going to disagree with you on that.
Okay, all right. The fellow who wrote the book, Rick Perlstein.
Rick Perlstein, yes.
Yeah, exactly. He's a smart guy.
Makes a lot. He's a very smart guy.
I think that still speaks to, as long as there are elite liberals running around, John Kerry types who tell us all to have renewable energy and then oppose
the guy
power.
That wouldn't have taken us to war in Iraq.
Kerry voted for the war.
Huh?
Kerry voted for the war in 2002.
I do not think that he would have taken us.
Maybe. But in any case, he certainly had us fooled back then, didn't he? When it mattered. When Bob Schrum told him, look, be for the war because it's a better vote, he and Hillary, both Kerry and Hillary were both listening to their eternal discredit. And I give eternal admiration to those brave...
Russ Feingold, yes.
25 or 26 U.S. senators who voted against it. They look pretty good history now. But all I'm saying is that again, Nixon didn't start the Vietnam War. What Nixon was canny about in figuring out was that the American people, again, didn't want to lose. And so he said, okay, we won't lose. We'll just simply negotiate and bomb and negotiate until we figure out some sort of settlement that lets, as Henry Kissinger said, a decent interval go by. Before we lose, I think that's good advice. I think that anybody who aspires to lead this country would do well to listen to that kind of wisdom. And I think that that's where McCain, like the American people don't want war with Iran, and they don't want war with Russia. But they also don't want stereotypical liberal defeatism either. And that's why this is a close election.
I think that you are not giving appropriate weight to the things that Americans care about right now. They care about health care. They care about their jobs. They care about the price of gas, which I think you do appreciate. And I don't think that John McCain's bellicosity, as evidenced in the way that he wanted to deal with the Georgia situation, is taking the country in a direction that it wants to go. Now, unfortunately, you've got a lot of the media buying into this narrative about Barack Obama being an elitist, which I'm frankly gobsmacked that because it's something that anybody could buy looking at John McCain in comparison. But it is troublesome, and I think it has plagued Barack Obama.
Could it have something to do with Obama saying that everybody in Georgia needs to learn Spanish? Did that hurt him?
He said that everybody in Georgia needs to learn Spanish.
He said our kids in Georgia, their kids didn't learn Spanish.
I think that our kids should learn Spanish, okay, and French, right. And German. That's the way that they raise people in Europe, and they raise them to live in an international community. If I had a kid right now, I'd have them learning Chinese. Okay. And I know that may scare you, but I think that's a really practical thing to do. It has nothing to do with nationalism or not loving your country, and that's what they're trying to portray it as.
It does appear, though, I mean, it's the liberal cliche in places like, you know, here in D.C., like, you know, Tacoma Park and, you know, the Palisades in D.C., is that, you know, kids, in the name of solidarity with the people of El Salvador and whatnot, we will all learn Spanish so that we can talk to our nannies and stuff like that. And I think that, again, Obama's sort of background is he's comfortable in inner city Chicago, and he's comfortable with George Soros and other billionaires and so on like that. He just seems to have a little trouble communicating with, you know, rank and file red state Americans. And that's just, I mean, again, the polls seem to show that.
Red state America is shrinking. Their message is not the message that seems to be appealing to the people that you're talking about seems to be waning. The whole idea of let's go beat up our enemies doesn't really seem to be playing that.
I agree with you. I mean, I think, but the point is, I would give more credit. Look, and let me also be clear on healthcare. One of the reasons why I volunteered, I quit my job to go help Mike Huckabee. Earlier this year was precisely because I do think that we need a better deal for ordinary Americans on health care and education and so on. I think those are incredibly important issues. I think the social contract has very much frayed in the last 10 or 20 or 30 years, however long it's been. Although, again, I'm always amused when I hear people talking about health care and how important it is to have universal health care or something close to universal health care. And I say, okay, should it include illegal aliens? And, I don't think that any health care plan, and I'm sitting here right now in the offices of the New America Foundation, and their effort in California, which I very much supported, is in concept foundered over this issue of illegals. If Elliot Spitzer couldn't get driver's licenses for illegals, which are free basically, through blue New York State, then what are the chances that we're going to get a healthcare system that hands out $5,000 or $10,000 a year per person to illegals, or pardon me, undocumented aliens, through any legislature this side of Berkeley, California? I don't think it'll happen.
I'll tell you a funny story that I heard from a pollster. It was Celinda Lake, and she was speaking at a healthcare symposium. And they had done a study on whether the average American considered the term illegal immigrant to be worse than undocumented alien. And they actually found that people responded more negatively to undocumented alien because they figured it was really easy to go down to the corner and buy yourself a fake ID. And anybody who couldn't do that had to be really stupid. So illegal immigrant is actually a term that people respond to more favorably than undocumented.
Well, and of course, if I were truly PC, I'd be saying migrant. Or I'd come up with some new phrase to speak to all this. And again,
what I'm basically telling you is okay to say illegal alien.
Okay.
Illegal aliens is okay.
Fair enough. That's very honest of you. But this is an empirical question. I will bet you a dollar that cup of coffee at Starbucks that the word illegal alien does not appear in the Democratic Committee's national platform.
I haven't read it, so I can't tell you, I wouldn't take your bet.
Right, exactly. And so, in other words, I think that the point is, whatever PC preciousness might have overtaken them and purged the word illegal alien, and hasn't changed the issue. And so, again, as somebody who supports health care for everyone, I would just put in the one caveat, every citizen. And it will be an interesting test of which vision of the Democratic Party. And again, in all my analysis here, there's no doubt in my mind the Democrats are going to win huge majorities in the House and Senate, mostly because the Democrats can, at the local level and the state level, can produce candidates more in tune with their states. In Missouri it seems to be a close state, for example, mm-hmm. and I would bet that McCain wins Missouri. But I just saw in the poll the other day that had Nixon, who's the Democratic candidate with a sort of unfortunate name, I guess, running for governor there. It's like 11 or 12 points ahead.
I think he's been up as much as 18. Yes.
Okay. In other words, so there's a case where if it's 18 points, let's say 15 points just for fun, that means one voter in seven in Missouri is going to vote for could quite possibly vote different. Between the presidents, vote Republican for president and Democratic for governor, which is actually an argument that I made in a piece I wrote for the Fox News blog the other day, in which I said, look, the easiest single explanation as to why McCain is going to win is because Americans like divided government. In the 62 years since 1946, the government has been divided between the White House and the Congress in 37 of those years. People just think that it's their own version of checks and balances. And out of those 62 years, what statisticians call the mode, the modal number, is 22, which is the number of years that the Republicans held the White House and the Democrats held the Congress. So in other words, I mean, the single most typical pattern in American politics is Republican president, Democratic Congress. And I think that's, again, a testament to two things. One, the ability of the Democrats to run candidates state by state, district by district, who are pretty closely in tune with the voters, or more closely in tune with the voters. And then at the same time, the inability of the National Party to break the hammerlock of left-wing groups who say no to Richard Gephardt and no to, Joe Biden, and yes to people like Obama and John Kerry. And I think it's a unresolved problem for Democrats that I think will be left for them to figure out anew in the wake of the November 2008.
Well, let's break it away for a second from liberal canards and generalizations about elites and talk about a candidate, Barack Obama, who has a history of running slow but strong over time, ever since he started running for office. Once people got comfortable with the idea of voting for him, it just kept coming in waves and waves. He's a very strong finisher. And if you look at the Hillary Clinton memos, early on, they didn't even consider him a serious contender. You can say what you will about him policy-wise. Believe me, I have my limitations with things that he says. He is not liberal enough for me by a long shot. I'm more of the Russ Feingold school of thought. But Barack Obama is a terrific candidate to come as far as he has, as fast as he has. And there's no affirmative action in politics. You live and die by what's going on when people pull the lever. And that's a very democratic process. And he's a strong finisher. I think that going forward, the more exposure he gets, the more people get comfortable with him, the more they spend time with what he thinks and hear what he has to say, he just is speaking to the concerns of Americans way more than John McCain is. And John McCain's money and his rich wife and all of the things that his life of privilege have bought him, I don't think are going to carry him through this.
Then how do you explain the poll that said that by like 48% of the American people think that Obama's overexposed, and 26% of the American people think McCain is overexposed? I mean, and by the way, my interpretation is obviously everybody knows who McCain is. I mean, he's probably got 99% name ID in the country. I think the answer is that even though they know McCain, they still kind of are curious about him and they want to hear more about him. And I think Obama's got the opposite problem. I think he's sort of a situation where the polls show they don't really like him that much.
I don't think that's true at all. He's winning. But the thing is that Obama had a long primary situation where a heavily contested primary situation where he was in the news every day, whereas John McCain could just kind of be on cruise control. So it's easy to say people might think that they've seen too much of Barack Obama, I don't think that that is going to be necessarily determinant of how they pull the lever when November comes.
Well, you might be right. I mean, look, certainly the election context of, you know, the 75-80% wrong track, you know, the clear failure of the Bush administration in many, many areas, has left us as a great Democratic year. But something tells me that the conservative in me, and I don't mean the ideological conservative, I just mean sort of the instinctive conservative in me, says if certain patterns have prevailed in the past, they will prevail in the future. And those patterns include, in wartime, you want a war-oriented, military-oriented leader.
People don't want to be at war.
Well, we are. And I think that is the
people want somebody who's going to get them out of the war.
They turn on the TV and see the Russians attacking Georgia. We had, in the scheme of things, very little. I'll sit still for any discussion about, you know, secret treaties and alliances and whatnot with Georgia and understandings and links and things like that. But the fact is, the Russians attacked the country and are bombing people. That's just sort of a military reality. That, you know, people, I think it's just going to be incredibly important to people. And this is how, you know, the Israelis turned to Ariel Sharon and the French turned to De Gaulle and the Americans turned to U.S. Grant and, you know, Zachary Taylor and, you know, Dwight Eisenhower and so on. I think the stars are all in an odd way lining up for McCain.
Well, I think this may be the time when the conservatives in the Republican Party turn to the Ron Paul wing and say, we've had enough foreign interventionism.
If Ron Paul were running, I think it would be much more a factor. Unfortunately, from the point of view of a libertarian or the point of view of a partisan Democrat, Ron Paul's not running. It's kind of curious that he would go to all the trouble of becoming a pretty significant candidate in the Republican primaries, raise a ton of money, not get that many votes, actually. But raise a lot of money and cause a big splash, and then decide in his 70s to then run for re-election to Congress. I like Ron Paul and I like the fellow that the Libertarian Party nominated, Bob Barr.
They're causing a real stir in the Republican Party.
I think Bob Barr is a good guy and has got a pretty good critique of both parties. But I don't think he's. I think it's, even his best friend would say that he's not going to get as many votes as Paul. And so the chance that, I mean, look, Bob Barr may well get, you know, a couple percent of the vote, and that could be decisive. Look, I'm the first to say that this election is close and we're paying attention to, and so on.
Bob could throw Georgia.
I don't think he'll throw Georgia. I think that he might get. I don't care how many votes Barr gets in Georgia. You know, Obama's, McCain's going to win Georgia.
Bob says he's getting 22% among conservatives in Georgia.
I think
Bob told me so.
Okay, I know, fair enough. I like Barr. I'm going to call him an optimist.
Yeah, I thought it was kind of optimistic too, but I didn't want to tell him.
Anyway. All right. Well.
So let's talk about the all the Democrats being happy that extra happy that in the wake of the Hillary Clinton memos that Barack Obama is the nominee, especially considering what happened to John Edwards this week.
Oh right. And also it is interesting to think. I mean, what happened? I saw a headline. I didn't read the article. What would, if you taken Edwards out of the race in this last year? What would have happened? And I think the answer was that Hillary probably would have won. It was that Edwards was kind of dividing the sort of moderate white vote with Hillary, and therefore leaving the field open to Obama. But obviously,
Edwards was unquestionably the most liberal candidate.
I know that, but his takeaway on Edwards is still Southern white. And I think I understand that Edwards ran way to the left.
Was he not the victim of affirmative action?
The point is, but just look, it's just the accent and the life story led a certain number of, you know, what soon came to be called Hillary Clinton Democrats to like him. He was kind of one of them. And, I realized that the policies that Edwards espoused in the last couple of years were way to the left of anybody, including Obama, but of course, who thinks Edwards meant any of it, right? And So, you know, he would have changed back and forth. He would have been a DLC Democrat again if he thought he wanted to be, or you know, whatever. I must say that this has been, you know, in a time of serious concerns and serious issues, the whole Edward story has been almost a little bit of levity.
I agree.
In the midst of all this, and to watch, you know, all his incredible list of evasions, and you know, I'm not the first to say that you know, the media kind of, you know, have egg on their face in terms of, and remind people why, you know, upstart outfits like the Huffington Post, which I think do us great credit. Almost a year ago now, I was talking about the Edwards stuff. I think that's where I first saw it.
And Edwards was mad about it too.
I'm sure he was.
He was pissed at Ariana for that.
And yet, it was true. And I'm still sort of amused to see that, you know, this lawyer who apparently is paying all of Reilly Hunter's bills and so on. I mean, I think there's a lot more yet to be dug up on this stuff, and I hope somebody does, frankly.
Yeah, and I don't know how much it more deserves, but I think we're going to get a lot, because I think she's nuts.
Well, I must say, I'm resolved to, I'm not really a Jay McInerney novel reader, but
are you going to read that? You're going to read the story? I know everybody is. There's so much there. Her friend's name is Pigeon.
Well, I'm going to... I'm sure if I Googled it, I could find you know, all the good stuff. If Slate or somebody will do it. They'll just simply say, here's all the good stuff about her and Jay and whoever else, you know.
Well, Sally Quinn has a really reprehensible, you know, she does that whole faith column in the Washington Post that's more hectoring.
What did you call it?
Sally Quinn.
What did you call it?
It's the On Faith column.
Oh, On Faith.
I believe, which is more about fingernail wagging, moralizing. Where she says that it's the responsibility of these women to call out their political husbands if they're cheating and expose them to the world. And I just thought that was really a bit much, that, you know, in spite of everything else that they were trying to hold together, their life, their health, their families, their kids, that what they really did was owe it to the media to out these people. Yeah, their private group. Let's expose your kids to that. I mean, I don't even know what the logic is behind that.
Yeah, I mean, it's like... I remember back in 1996, you know, Ted Koppel saying, this convention at ABC News, this convention is boring to me, so I'm going home. You know, I'm sorry, Ted, you know, we didn't really realize that our purpose here was to entertain you. Right, I mean, media smugness is something that, you know, people from all points of view and spectrum can unite around. The joy of sticking a pincushion upwards into these people, and I mean, look, that's funny. I had not seen that Sally Quinn piece. I mean, it is. I mean, obviously, the Elizabeth Edwards story, tragic as it is in all possible dimensions, is still pretty darn interesting. I mean, just as to exactly, you know, what was she thinking, and what was he telling her, and what was she believing or choosing to believe, and. Again, I'm sure somebody's going to, some smart Alex is going to come up with this, you know, the idea of, okay, let's get the IRS in here and let's figure out, you know, who's, what the income tax status of all these payments is. I mean, was Reilly Hunter reporting as income? Was Mr. Barron reporting this as a gift? I mean, I don't know. I don't know enough about how this stuff works, but I just guarantee that if you move that much money, ask Elliot Spitzer, that much money around, you've triggered some law or some tax concern.
Well, I'm a big believer that your private life is your private life. And I defended Elliot Spitzer and I defended Bill Clinton, but I'm having a hard time defending John Edwards. You know, I mean, whatever his deal is with Elizabeth, that's their private business, but you've got this woman, and he took her, did you see Grant Frank Ruta did a piece on the trail in the Washington Post this morning? And it showed the pictures of Hunter and John Edwards on the plane in December, at the very end of 2006, when he was announcing his candidacy. And they're sitting there in the plane, like the two of them, like holding court to the press. And you're just going, this wasn't a momentary lapse. This was part of the John Edwards traveling roadshow. Whatever, you know, whatever this thing was, this was his shtick. And he paid for her out of the the poverty campaign funds, and she'd never made a movie before.
And of course, the anti-poverty campaign has now disappeared.
Yeah.
They pulled I saw that in Harper's or something. They pulled the plug on all that stuff. I mean, Edwards just lost interest in this. And I saw some of those pictures too, I think, in the Washington Post this morning. And one of them was, it was like they were like in an 8-seat plane.
Yeah, the plane picture. It just bugs you. You look at there's something really wrong here.
So who's, I mean, usually the candidate, you know, I mean, Mike Huckabee never went anywhere without Janet Huckabee, just to, you know, be sentimental about these things. And
they were cute.
They were cute, and the rest of the people on the plane tended to be sort of like the campaign manager and, you know, the campaign chairman and, you know, so on. And, I mean, if you have a tiny plane, you're flying around, and you get one of 8 seats or maybe even 4 seats to your girlfriend, you know, who's getting left behind? I mean, who's the communications director, the political director, somebody is going to have to drive.
I don't know how he comes back from this, honestly. I mean, politics is full of second chances, but he was counting on folks like me to, you know, to be there and care enough about what he believed in. To be able to see it through, and exactly, you know, $114,000 for some woman who, and I don't know why her, you know? He's married to Elizabeth Edwards, she's classy, she's wonderful, she's smart, she's great, and he picks this woman who is a few bricks short of a load, man. She's just like, you just know that the tabloid TV will go on forever.
Yeah, right. How long before she gets her own? You know,
exactly. Her 15 minutes of fame is just going to be stretched out forever.
But what was that show? The one, like, The Surreal Life or something?
Yeah, exactly.
With like, the late Anna Nicole Smith and so on. I mean,
Surreal Life. That was Paris Hilton, who is looking awfully politically astute with her response to John McCain these days.
Right. I thought Paris Hilton's plan, as I recall, was sort of like, you know, have more energy, and then, yeah, I mean, it was just, I thought, I supported, I mean, I suspect in her heart of hearts, Paris Hilton's a Republican. I mean, I'm not overly eager to claim her, but I suspect it's true.
I think
the family's Republican, I think she's sort of into conspicuous conception. I mean, why shouldn't she be?
She's rich and spoiled, and hasn't worked too hard, I bet she's a Republican. In the John McCain mold, although I give her some credit.
All right, Jane, I want you to know, as we wrap up here, our little time, you definitely get credit for, and you should get brownie points with the Democrats for meritoriously bringing up Cindy McCain and the beer heiress thing like 30 times.
I figured I had to match you once for every time you said elite liberal.
That's fine. Certainly. If you know, in the old days, you know, the mainstream media would have had a lot of reporters digging into the Hensley family and so on, and who knows what they would have found. I mean, but it will be. My only point, and this is sort of where I'll leave off here, is I think that the interest in Cindy McCain's life and all the things she's done, including the good things like adopting that girl from Bangladesh and so on, and doing a lot of overseas international charity work, a lot more than Paris Hilton, is something that will be very much explored, and I think people will have occasion to do it over.
I've actually given Christine. I am not into exposing spouses and dragging them through the mud, and I've actually given Cindy McCain credit for her charity work, which I think has been admirable.
Okay.
That is not what anything I've said about Cindy McCain has been meant to reflect.
So you separate Cindy McCain from beer.
I separate John McCain's notion of being a self-made man from his wife's money.
I don't think McCain ever says he's a self-made man. I think he says he's a patriot and done the things. And what does strike me about McCain, I think it is worth noting in this, is including, and Cindy McCain gets half the credit for this, is that McCain has two children in the armed forces right now. And that is what I think rings the bell of, you know, big swaths of this country, you know, who may not watch blogging heads much, but do actually, you know, fight the wars this country fights. And McCain has a kid in the Marines and a kid in Annapolis, who will either be in the Navy or the Marines somewhere soon.
This country elected George Bush, draft dodging Bush, over John Kerry, war hero. So I'm not sure it means as much as you'd like to think it does.
I'll tell you something about John Kerry. I can remember, I'm old enough to remember back in 1971 when Kerry spoke to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. I remember that very, very vividly. And I remember, you know, all the Jane Fonda types cheering. And I said back in 2003 and 2004, I said, look, the American people will never elect a guy who trashed the military like that.
But he was in the military.
I know. It doesn't matter. You can't trash the military like that. And guess what? I was right. They didn't, and they never would. So there are certain, again, this is lessons for liberals. There are certain rules
about...
I
think that you were in a post-9/11 atmosphere where running with that was probably very tough. I'm not sure that same thing would be true today.
Well, I think that if Kerry had kept his mouth shut in 1971, he would not have had the Smith voters after him.
Kerry's critique in 71 was legitimate, and he was over there in Vietnam and
well,
he heard
again,
the
right
to say
this
that.
This is these are lessons. Folks, do not listen to Jane. Listen to me. Do not.
I'm sure that I'm sure liberals are sitting there taking notes, Jim.
Do not trash. Well, maybe if they are, do not trash the military and then expect to get elected commander in chief. That is just an iron rule of politics. And Kerry broke it and never recovered. So if you aspire to lead this country, you must have a more positive attitude toward the troops, especially in wartime. And that's the word from me, Jane. You can, but I'll give you the last word because that's the right thing to do.
I appreciate that. I think that we have fortunately grown from that era, in that we're no longer blaming the troops on the ground occasionally, as did happen back then. Although John Kerry was not guilty of that.
Oh, he totally was guilty of that. That's exactly what he did. He said they committed war crimes, like Genghis Khan.
For crimes that their superiors were responsible for. That does not mean that individual troops on the ground did not commit crimes and were not responsible for them. But I think we have grown and we're capable of seeing that George Bush and the culture that he created around the Iraq War are more guilty than the individual soldiers who were over there committing the abuses at Abu Ghraib. That it's not a few bad apples, that it's systemic, and that John McCain is hugging George Bush just as tight as he can. He tried to legitimize torture. He's voted for it. He's used his own status as a POW in order to try and make that okay. And I don't think Americans want to be that anymore. I think they tried it. They thought, you know, they were told that if we did all these things that we could purge the world of all its ills, and that didn't happen. We are not looking too good either in our own eyes or in the eyes of the international community, and I think that we want to be hopeful once again, and I think that Barack Obama offers hope to people on that front, and I think that that's going to be victorious in November.
Okay. Jane?
It was a pleasure talking with you.
Nice talking to you. Thanks to Blogging Heads, and we will stop capture now and wrap this up.
All right.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.